Okay, 1 Peter chapter 4. All right, let's start before we get into verse 7 there. What is the main idea in the book of 1 Peter? Well, there are a couple we could mention, but what are the main focuses of 1 Peter? Okay. Yeah, okay. They are dealing with suffering, right? So this is how they're going to have to deal with it. He gives them reasons to be encouraged as they're going through these sufferings. You remember that Nero is ruling in Rome at this time. Sufferings are coming. Persecutions are coming on Christians. Even at this, we know Peter's writing this, but it's not going to be very long. Peter himself is going to become a victim of that persecution. He'll lose his life in the next few years from this time. Paul would as well. So this is very real. It's impacting the Christians. It's impacting the faith. This is a problem they're going to have to deal with. He, in this book, is writing to Christians who are in the area of Asia Minor. He describes it as the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Bithynia, those regions around what we would probably refer to in sort of an umbrella way as Asia Minor. Those saints were dealing with it as well. Certainly in Rome, they were facing all of those troubles. This letter is written as an encouragement to them, and the reminder is, no matter what happens to you in this life, heaven is worth it. Heaven is worth going through all of these troubles and all of these problems. Whatever this world throws at you, heaven is worth staying focused and staying true to God. We see that chapter 1, verse 4, an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. Basically, Peter's saying, my brethren, there's some rough stuff going on. It may get worse. But you've got something waiting on you that's worth going and enduring all of this. So stay focused. Realize that you're not the only ones going through these things. He'll talk about that. We should get to see that tonight as well. Good. Now go to verse 7 in chapter 4. It says, but the end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be serious and watchful in your prayers. The end of all things is at hand. There will come a day when everything ends. So you need to have clear minds. And you need to be serious in your prayers. This world will end one day when Jesus comes back. When will that be? We don't know. He doesn't tell us. He doesn't give us the time. But it will happen. We can know that with confidence that it will happen. He says it is at hand. Now, at hand here is likely relative. What is the only thing that remains left out of God's plan? What's the only thing that is left undone at this point?
Coming back.
His return. Yeah, everything else has been taken care of. His return is what is left. The phrase at hand sometimes means very, very near. I'm thinking of Matthew 3, verse 2, when John the Baptist is teaching that the kingdom is at hand. It was very near, right? It was coming very, very soon. They were on the cusp of it. Sometimes when at hand is used, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's coming right then. Deuteronomy 32, verse 35, Moses is talking about vengeance and the day of calamity is at hand. I think he's talking about Babylon there. But how long would it be before they were taken captive into Babylon from then? 900 years? I mean, it'd be a long, long time. So this is the last thing, the only thing remaining to be done. So since that's all that remains, keep your minds focused, keep your minds clear, be watchful, be diligent in your prayers. Yeah, Terry.
Well, we have to take into consideration that we are not on the same timetable as God is on.
Sure.
You know, because we know that some scriptures say that 1,000 years is like one day to God.
Right.
So we're not on the same timetable, so we don't know what day Christ is coming back on, so the day is always at hand.
Yeah, and that's the idea. Be prepared, because you don't know when it's going to be. So always act like it's going to be any moment now. Be prepared. Have that mindset. Still the same idea that he's given them here. Notice what he puts after this in verse 8. Above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. Again, you see this emphasis on loving one another. Does it seem like we've been talking about that a lot lately? And not only in this class, but as we're going through the New Testament church, that idea keeps coming up and keeps coming up. Why do you think it keeps coming up?
It's
Okay. The Bible talks about it a lot. And it doesn't matter if it's Peter here or John, certainly talks about it a lot. Jesus talked about it a lot. So this is a theme that runs throughout the New Testament. It really runs throughout the Old Testament too. But it certainly, we see it in the New Testament. Above all things. Why stress it like that?
Because if we had a proper love for God and proper love for our fellow man, everything else would fall into place.
Okay, yeah, that's good. Think about how much easier is it to get along with brethren when that kind of love is being shown? When I have the love that puts you first in your concerns and your needs first, what happens between us? With our relationship, when problems or potential problems come up. If I love you like this, will I be able to forgive you when you ask for it? Yeah, absolutely. If I love you like this, will I come to you when you wrong me so we can make sure we work it out? I won't hold these bitter thoughts in. Will I give you the benefit of the doubt in issues? And so it just... Love will lead to all those things, and so sin ends up being covered. I don't want us to misunderstand that, though. Peter's not changing God's plan for repentance. When sin occurs, must repentance occur? Yeah, and he expects that, always. The idea here of it being covered. If I say to you, I covered your debt, does that mean that I ignored it? What does it mean I did?
Paid it.
Took care of it. Yeah, paid it. It's been taken care of. And I think the same idea is being presented here. A multitude of sins are covered. Why? Because they're ignored? Because they're taken care of. They get handled. And they get handled in a godly way. Now, consider the opposite of that. If we don't have that love for each other, when you offend me, what will I do? If I don't love you like I should?
You try to do whatever it takes to get even.
I try to get back. I may undermine you and badmouth you and all of these things. So what happens to sin, instead of being covered,
it grows.
It gets multiplied. Yeah. So when that love is not there like it should be, all kinds of problems come out. Bitterness and wrath, they're awful, and they just sort of fester when that's the situation. Good. Tim, did I see a hand?
Psalm 32 starts off by saying, blessed is the man whose sin has been forgiven. And that's been covered. And so it has this idea of not just ignore. It's not that we're covering up in the way that we think of as covering up. It's that it's been resolved. And the rest of that psalm is David talking about his own sin and how that was. And that needed to include confession and repentance.
Yeah. Good. What about 9? If this is the case and we love each other like we should, what happens with 9? Be hospitable to one another without grumbling.
It's going to be automatic.
It's going to be a lot easier, right? This is just a natural outpouring. If I love you like I should, then when it comes to hospitality, what will I show? Because I have to?
Because I want to.
Because I want to, yeah. Because I have that bond and that affection for my brethren, I want to do that. Look at 10. I understand that in the first century, miraculous spiritual gifts were bestowed. Certainly the apostles had them, and through the laying on of hands, various other saints had them as well. And you can make an application here that were miraculous spiritual gifts, would they have been beneficial toward others?
Yes.
Sure. Right. I mean, healing? Would that have been beneficial toward others? Yeah, sure. And the speaking of tongues and various things. But look at verse 10. As each one has received a gift, minister it to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. So I think you can make an application for miraculous spiritual gifts, but I don't think that gifts here is limited to just the miraculous. If it were, it wouldn't have that benefit for us today. Does this verse still have a benefit for us? Are there gifts that we have today that we can use for the benefit of one another? What are they?
If you've been monetarily blessed, we should be using that to help needy brethren, or even a stranger, we can use it as a way of, if they're in need of something, we can use that as an opportunity to open up, to teach Christ and give and help an individual.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, physical blessings like that, certainly, can they be used to benefit others? We don't even have to answer that. Obviously, they can. Let's think about maybe not
encouraging each other.
Okay. Some people are good encouragers, aren't they?
Yeah.
What happens when they do that? What does it do for those who come in contact with them?
It makes them feel so much better.
It builds them up. There are some people who absolutely light up a room when they walk into it. They just do. Mike and Kelly's daughter Kaylee is one. She, if you can't smile when Kaylee's around, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do for you. She just has that ability. Is that a benefit to others when someone has that? Absolutely, it is. Some are good listeners. Man, I wish there were more of those. Some are good talkers. They can just get conversations going, and they can find out things, and not because they're prying, but because they're looking for opportunities to genuinely help. They're good planners. All of those things are gifts. Not all of us have all of those, but if we do, use them, and use them for the benefit of others. Verse 11, I think it's just so important. If anyone speaks, let him speak as the oracles of God. What is an oracle of God? What does that mean? Okay, an utterance of God. In other words, if you're going to speak, say what God said. Right? Mm-hmm. Say what He said. We don't need to come up with our own commentary and our own twist and our own spin, which unfortunately is what a lot of folks like to do. What you say about Scripture may completely affect how a person sees God and His Word. So I better be very careful what I say. What if I say what God says? What situation am I in then? I'm going to be safe, right? If I say what He says, I'm in a good position. What if I go beyond? I'm in a very dangerous position.
You're adding to it and you're going against what God said.
Okay, so there's one danger. When I start adding my own thoughts into it, what's the other side of that danger?
You're causing them to fall.
Yeah, it's a danger to anyone who hears it. It's a danger to me. What if I cut short and don't teach the whole counsel of God? It's just as dangerous because now I'm not presenting everything that He said. I'm basically picking, well, I like this and this, but this stuff, people aren't going to want to hear that, so I'm not going to teach it. I have no right to do that with His Word. Speak as He speaks. Speak as the utterances, the oracles of God. Go ahead, Bob.
That's what Satan found to Eve. God had told them that if they touched that tree, they would surely die. And Satan told them, you are not sure to die.
And how did that work out?
Well, they died.
Yeah, but they didn't die right there on the spot, or did they?
Yeah, they spiritually died.
That's right. They didn't die in the way they may have been thinking. They didn't physically kill over on the spot, but they were they separated from God spiritually.
Yeah,
that's an even worse death. And so, certainly, in the consequences of that, you're still dealing with. Good, Tim.
I wonder what this seemed like reading this in the first century, because Scripture, the New Testament, had not been collected yet. And so they had this combination of some of the letters from the apostles and then people amongst themselves who had the gift of prophecy. And those that whose responsibility it was to interpret. And so it was more of a challenge for them to test each spirit and to see whether these were the oracles of God, or whether somebody was just speaking on their own. And then for us, it's so much easier just to be diligent in our search for the truth.
If we're diligent, it's so much easier because we have the answers before us. We have the complete revealed will before us. And so it should be easier unless we're lazy. And then we're in the same position. We could just swallow down anything that might be presented. Steve, you had something too.
There's a qualification to being okay by saying what God says. You have to be sincere.
Yeah. Can you say the right things and do it with the wrong heart, the wrong motives? Yeah, those things are absolutely possible. You had the faith shown by doing the will of the Lord because you love Him and you want to do His will, but you also have the right heart that goes with it. And those things, you can't separate them. You know, we got the idea in James that we spend a lot of time talking about. Here is faith. But in that hall of faith, let's just go back, Hebrews 11, which we'll talk about, Lord willing, in the next month. By faith, what? Every time. It is demonstrated through obedience, through their action. Separate faith from obedience. Try to. It's never meant to be. That's never something that God ever would want us to do. Those two always go together. Here's, and if someone tries to separate it, if you say that any Bible character you want to, they have faith. Show me. How do you know? How did Abraham have faith?
By his works.
Okay, well, what about Joshua?
Well, they did exactly what God said, not in their own way. You know, and there's numerous accounts in the Bible where it shows that the ones that did exactly what God said, he was pleased, and the ones that did it but then changed a little bit and did it their way, God wasn't pleased. So there's no faith involved.
Oh, boy. And we can go back so many ways. You can go back to the beginning. You can go to Cain, right? Did he offer a sacrifice? Did he do it the way God wanted?
No.
And so right there, you've got a problem. Go to Nadab and Abihu as we get into Leviticus. Did they bring some fire?
Yes.
They did. Was it what God wanted?
No.
And then we can go, and I've been picking on him a lot over the 2017. King Saul, you know, when he was little in his own eyes, we talked about this Sunday. He was blessed. He was blessed to be ruler over all of Israel. But then, as somebody mentioned, he stopped being little. He got big in his own eyes. And then what happened with his actions? He started doing what he wanted to. He started, I did exactly as you told me I should do, Samuel. And here's the sheep bleeding in the background. And that would almost be funny if it wasn't so absolutely disrespectful of God. I did everything you told me to, killed everybody, and then here's the stuff in the background. Obviously, he didn't. And so, you guys understand that. Let's go on. Look in verse 12. I love this verse. And I need to remind myself of it when things pop up. Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you. But rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when His glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. Don't be surprised when suffering comes your way for the sake of Jesus. Why not be surprised? He let you know ahead of time. If you serve Him, it's going to happen. And it's not only going to happen to you, but who else will it happen to?
Everybody.
Which should be taken as what?
Proof
of what he said. Also, isn't that encouraging to know that your brethren in other places are dealing with the same thing you are? It's not just something that I'm having to deal with. Can I look to examples of people who have gone through similar things and come through their faith strong and their trust in God what it should be? Can you think of examples?
Yeah, because it motivates you to, you know, you're like, well, if they can do it, so can I.
Yeah, absolutely. Good. What does it say to do instead of thinking it strange? And I think what goes with this is worrying and being upset over it and just letting... Yeah, rejoice. Take joy in this fact. Jesus will return. He will. And His faithful will be glorified with Him throughout eternity. He has promised that. Can you take confidence in it? No question. Absolutely. This will be it. Looking through verse 14 and 15, we talked about this idea before. If persecution comes to you because you're faithful to the Lord, then you are blessed. If persecution comes to you, or if trouble comes to you because you do something wrong, that's completely different. And that's the kind of suffering of the world. He says in verse 15, if you suffer as an evildoer, that's something else. But 16, if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed. Let him glorify God in this matter. Verse 17 is kind of an interesting one. If For the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God. And if it begins with us first, what will the end be of those who do not obey the gospel? And what's the answer to that question?
Eternal death.
It'll be awful. It will be awful. If judgment begins at the house of God, then what about those who reject Him? And Christians striving to live faithfully, even if they're misjudged by the world, how will they be judged in the end time?
Righteously.
Absolutely righteously. They will be judged by a fair and righteous judge. They'll be found in harmony with God, and so they'll be blessed. So even if they face wrong judgment by men in this life, they will be blessed then. But what about those who do not obey the gospel? They will face a fair judgment, but that wrath will be horrible. And this is something certainly that Peter's warning about here. Okay, chapter 5. Starts by addressing the elders, but let's take some comments on this. Yeah, Tim, go ahead.
Before we move on.
Sure.
Neither of the elders are here tonight, but verse 9 fits in with the vision and theme that they're wanting to emphasize this year. And it occurred to me that I'd like your insight to what it means to show hospitality to one another without grumbling. My type of personality, that gives me energy. That's exciting to me. That's enjoyable to me. But my wife is not at the same place. She prefers a different type of hospitality. And sometimes we can run counter to each other in our effort to provide hospitality.
And in both of those, I don't see either one of those as being the warning here that he's giving. When I read this, the be hospitable without grumbling is the person who does not take joy in it. They treat it as though it's a chore. Well, I got to do it because I just got a letter from Peter that said I got to love my brethren. And then I got one from John the other, you know. And so that's how I've always taken this, is the heart is not one that truly loves. Now, based on our personalities, can we be different in our approach to hospitality? Yeah, not every hospitality has to be the same. You know, in the South, when you mention hospitality, most people think food. And that can be a part of it. It doesn't have to be. I mean, going and visiting somebody who was at the nursing home and spending time with them, talking to them and asking them questions about what they did when they were a little girl, is that hospitality? It absolutely is. I mean, hospitality, the idea is that showing of love, so it really can include a lot of things. So in the example that Tim gave, I don't think either one of those approaches is violating what Peter's warning about here. This is the one who would grumble. This is the one who, I don't want to do it, but I feel like I have to. And I certainly think we can show hospitality in different ways, and in those ways we're most comfortable with. Sasha?
Just like Tim mentioned, you mentioned showing hospitalities in different ways based on our personalities and our strong suits. Mm-hmm. But as far as receiving hospitality, people's personalities are different. It wasn't too long ago that we went to visit a friend of ours who is older, is on oxygen, has a lot of problems with severe rheumatoid arthritis, you know, can't walk around very well at all. And, you know, she wanted to see us, but we were told, keep it to 20 minutes. Yeah. You know, and that's not rude. And that's not her not wanting to receive the hospitality, the visit. It was just a physical limitation that she had. Or it could be an emotional... You know, if people aren't good with crowds, you know, everybody's personality is different. And so we need to take that also into consideration when we're giving hospitality. You know, I just made this huge cake. Why won't they take it? You know, well, maybe they don't like sweets, you know, or, you know, we've got this big crowd and we want to come over and do this. Well, maybe that makes them
extremely uncomfortable,
extremely nervous, you know, claustrophobic, or whatever. You know, that doesn't mean that's wrong either.
Yeah, with that idea, go to 2 Peter real quick. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but you know, when it starts around verse 5 there in 2 Peter 1, and here add this trait, and add this trait, and add this trait. Notice there. I'm reading out of the New King James Version, verse 6, to knowledge, self-control. And of course, the understood idea there is to knowledge, add self-control. To self-control, perseverance. To perseverance, godliness. And I think perseverance, some of the other translations have patience there. That's where that trait comes in, right? Being able to be patient and persevere with each other. Because sometimes somebody might respond even to my hospitality in a way where I'm like, what in the world? It's going on. Why won't they accept this? If I am mature like I need to be, and I approach that with perseverance and patience, can I get to the root of the problem most of the time and see maybe what's going on? It's going to take some time, and it's going to take some understanding, and that takes maturity and the willingness to do this, to be patient and to persevere, and not to just throw your hands up and say, well, forget it, I'll never do anything for them again. That's not the right answer. I just need to keep kind of chipping away and figuring out how I can do that. Something Sasha said also reminded me of the opposite side of this. It's something that I've not been very good with through the years. Sometimes we don't let people show hospitality to us. You know? We were like, I got it. I'll do it. I handle everything by myself. No, don't do this for me. I'm fine. I appreciate it, but don't do it. I understand why we do that. But if this person is really, really wanting to show hospitality, if I don't let him, now what am I doing? I'm getting in the way of him trying to grow. This may be something that he hasn't done a lot of in the past. And so he's trying to reach out. And can you imagine, you're trying to become better at hospitality and the first person you go to says, nah, thanks, I don't want that. Well, that he's going to be a lot less likely to try it again. So I know where we're coming from. I don't want to put anybody out. You don't want to put anybody out of stuff. But if our brethren are trying to be hospitable, let them. Let them do those things. Steve, yeah.
You're keeping them from doing what God told them to
do. Absolutely. And now I'm a stumbling block to my brother, and I meant to have the very best intentions. So, you know, sometimes just get out of the way and let them do that. Something else to consider.
Sometimes we have the attitude, I wish they hadn't invited me. Now we got to invite them to our house.
Which goes back to verse 9. But that's right. Like, great. Great. Well, I guess, what are we doing next Friday, Sasha? I guess clear the schedule. That's the kind of thing that Peter's addressing here. Just don't go down that path. Bobby.
I was just thinking about a neighbor that I used to have when I looked at verse 8. Talking about have fervent hospitality, charity. My neighbor used to tell me once in a while, he called me Mr. B. He said, Mr. B, we care about you. He wouldn't say we love you, he said, we care about you.
Yeah.
So I didn't let him say that.
Yeah. 5 starts out, chapter 5 starts out with Peter addressing the elders. And, you know, a lot of times the religious world uses the word pastor to refer to preachers. The Bible never uses that. The only time you see pastors, we see it one time in the book of Ephesians, and it's referring to elders. And if you looked it up in a Greek dictionary, you'll see that. It always referred to the presbyters, to the bishops, to the overseers, to the elders who are being addressed here. Elders are those men who meet certain qualifications, as given to Titus and Timothy, to oversee a local flock of God's people, to guide, to shepherd that local group of God's people. So this is who he's talking to at the beginning of chapter 5. The elders who are among you. Just one point I would make on that as well. We have 2 elders at Eastside. Their responsibility is for whom? It's toward him. Eastside. They have no authority whatsoever at South Fayette or at Auburn or anything else. They have elders in those places. Now, God said it and that's good enough, but there's some logic behind that too that even little old me can understand, right? What if you had Mike and Andy trying to oversee what's going on in Auburn? Do you see any problems with that setup?
Well, they can't take it, so they don't know what's going on.
They don't know what's going on. There's another problem even before that.
They don't have authority.
Don't have authority. Shepherds oversee who?
Their own flock.
Sheep. What's the problem with overseeing sheep over there?
They
know you?
I don't know those sheep, and those sheep don't know me. Right now, now we have an issue there. So this is the elders who are among you, I exhort, I urge, I encourage. And then he tells them another little piece of information here. We know that Peter's an apostle, apparently. What else is he? Also qualified to be an elder. Not surprising. We know that Peter was married. He is also a witness of the sufferings of Christ and a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. He just hits them with three things right there that are really powerful. He's a fellow elder. He's a witness of the sufferings of Christ, which really, isn't that what the apostles were? Their role to serve as ambassadors, as witness, eyewitnesses of the things that Jesus did and said. And also a partaker of the glory who will be revealed. Now, the interesting thing about that is, that's not limited to just the apostles. If we are faithful, can we be partakers of the glory that will be revealed? Absolutely. Absolutely we can. And now, that may require us to go through some of the suffering, too, that he's already addressed in this. Here's his command to them, verse 2. Shepherd the flock of God, which is among you. There's that phrase again, among you. Serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly. Not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. Let's just stop with that. Let's go through them verse by verse here on this. He's urging the elders forward in their duties, and he does it by establishing himself as someone who has experience. First of all, why is that helpful? By saying, I who am a fellow elder. Why would that be helpful to the brethren reading this? Okay, do you think there's a reason that a lot of times former players become coaches? Any reason? Do they know what they're talking about? And to those who would be playing for them, can you take them seriously? Yeah. What if I decide to be an NFL coach? Are they going to take me seriously? Probably not. Thanks for the encouragement, guys. I appreciate that. But no, they're not, because I don't have any experience. I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know what I'm doing. I haven't been able to do that. And so why in the world would these guys trust me to be able to lead them? But what if you have? What if you have gone through it? If Jerry Rice wants to be a wide receivers coach, would you listen to him? I would. I would very much listen to what he had to say, because he's been through it and he's excelled at it. Do you think they would see in Peter a man who was pretty good at doing what he did? So obviously, this has it. It carries more weight. And so he establishes that. So just wanted to throw that out there. This is shepherds. I love the fact verse 2 says, shepherd the flock. You're shepherds. What do you need to do? Shepherd. It is a work. It's not an honorary title. It's not something that you just get voted into because you finally got old enough and people are like, well, I mean, he's 95 now. What can we do for him? Let's name him an elder. That's not what it is. It is a work. And it involves a great deal of work. It is a good work. And notice what else. Let's go ahead, I guess. At the end of verse 2 there is to be a willing service. Nobody should ever be forced in the position of elder. I've heard of it happening, and it doesn't end well, right? That is a stressful job, to say the least. If you don't want to be there to begin with, and you get forced into that, how are you going to respond to those duties, and especially when stress comes up?
Begrudgingly.
Yeah, it's going to be begrudging. That's absolutely right, Jamie. I didn't want to be here to begin with, and now I've got to deal with all this. It's not going to be good for you. It's not going to be good for the flock. It is to be a willing, a choice to serve in that position.
Not for everybody either.
It's not.
You know, everybody don't have that mindset to oversee a group of people. You know, they don't have that self-control, that leadership ability. It's so many things that comes along with that. You have to be able to, you got to have a sober mind through some things like that, man. That's going to be tough.
And God really emphasizes that when he gives the qualifications. But a man may know himself better than the rest of us. You know, we may look and say, well, obviously this guy, he meets all of them. And he says, no, I don't. He may know something that I don't. And so, you know, certainly that's taking this soberly and considering it and thinking it, and not just running through it. The other thing from that verse that comes in, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. Let's talk about both of those. Don't do it for the wrong reasons. Don't do it for certainly to take advantage of anyone. Or we'll talk about in the next verse for the sake of power and lording it over others. But also do it eagerly. There's something to be said about that too, right? No, it's not just a figurehead or a placeholder. It is work, but it needs to be an energetic work. This needs to be something that is pursued and sought after and taken very, very seriously. Bobby, go ahead.
Peter said he was a witness of the suffering of Christ.
Yeah.
The so-called witnesses now haven't seen anything. They haven't seen Christ suffer.
Yeah, this when that word is used in the Scriptures, well, we know what an eyewitness is today. An eyewitness to a crime, what does that mean?
You saw what happened.
Yeah, they saw it. And so, was Peter an eyewitness of the suffering of Christ?
Yes.
He is. Am I?
No.
I have witnessed it through the writing that was recorded for me, but that's not the same thing. These men, and that's one of the things that was so special about the apostles, they had walked with him. They had actually seen these things, and so they were qualified to be eyewitnesses of those. Go ahead, Tim.
You know, part of this verse that says, imitate their example. For somebody to imitate a shepherd's example, they're going to have to be an open book. They're going to have to have that type of transparency that people can get to know them, to see their good faults, to see how they come back from the mistakes that they make, so that they can be an example. If elders are so busy trying to pull the wool over their sheep's eyes, then it's impossible to fulfill Hebrews 13.
Yeah.
Where we're told directly to consider their way of faith, to imitate their way of life. And we can't do that if we're not around them.
Notice what else is said there in verse 3. Nor is being lords. We've talked this idea of lording your authority over the flock. Never the intention for elders. Notice what's said next. As lords over those who were what to you?
Entrusted.
That is big. These souls have been entrusted into your keeping, your safeguarding. That's some serious responsibility. This is not a time to throw authority around and do things to build yourself up. You are responsible and you are to take care of them. That's a very, very big deal. And quite frankly, a lot of men are not mature enough to be entrusted with that. I'm not. I'll admit it to you. I'm not. That's why I don't meet the qualifications of an elder. I'm not to that point yet. I hope I will be one day. Not today. And I know that. And that's why this is a lifelong goal that I hope more younger men are working toward and trying to get to that point. I hope we're honest enough to admit we're not there right now, that we can look at ourselves and say, okay, here are the weaknesses, but understanding them, what do I need to know? Once I identify them and understand them, now what?
Put them in a play.
Yeah, work on them. Yeah, work on overcoming those things. You're still going to stumble. I understand that. Elders stumble too. But we can start working on these things now if we're honest with ourselves about where those weaknesses are. Good. Verse 4, when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. This is not just for elders, though, right? All the faithful will receive the crown of glory that shall not fade away. Here's the thing. These blessings, and certainly this is one of them, will come in this crown described there. The Greek word is Stephanos, the crown, a victor's crown is what's being talked about. To those who have endured and received the victory. Crown of life is available to all who serve God faithfully. We don't all serve in exactly the same way. Don't misunderstand me. Our worship is the same. Our beliefs, our practices are the same. But some of us have abilities that others don't have. Right? Not everybody leads singing. Right? Yeah. Not everybody feels comfortable teaching classes. We have different abilities. And so is the guy who absolutely just cannot stand before others, but he is so good at encouraging others. And he is so good at leading prayers, but he just falls to pieces when he has to teach a class. Is that guy going to be denied the crown of glory if he's using what ability he has to the very best of that ability, and he's trying to engage it and use it as much as he can? I guess this is my point. You could look at this and say, well, it says elders are going to get the crown of glory. What about everybody else? Elders are responsible for what they're responsible for. Now, when you take on that responsibility, that's pretty serious, because are you going to be judged as to how you handle that responsibility? Don't agree to be an elder without some serious, sober thought to that. It is, I'll be held responsible for whatever I've been entrusted with. You'll be held responsible for whatever you've been entrusted with. And for elders, there are certainly some added responsibilities there that would go along with that idea. Jamie?
Well, seeing as how you put it like that, the three guys, one got one penny or one
and the talents.
Know, the talents, and one got five and one got I'm just saying they were entrusted with what they knew how to use. And so that's the same with us. We are entrusted with what we know how to use, because I don't have some of the abilities that these other women do. I can't go back there and teach them children, but there are women that can, and the same goes for other people. They have, I may have something that they don't have, so I wouldn't put myself in a situation to teach those young children knowing that I don't have the ability to do that.
Was God mad at the one talent man because he only had one talent?
No.
Why was he mad? Because he didn't do anything with it. It was never the number of talent. It was never the amount of ability. What does he expect?
What you have.
To use what you got. And that's the thing. Was the five talent man, was he responsible for more than the one talent man?
Yes.
God expected him to use how many of those talents?
All of them.
And see, that's the thing, and I guess that's the point I'm trying to get at with elders here. They may have certain responsibilities that some of us, well, they do have certain responsibilities that some of us don't have. If they are faithful in those responsibilities, they'll receive a crown of life. And if I'm faithful in what I've been given, I will too. So it's certainly nobody's getting left.